unexamined life is not worth living.
For kids who are, let's say, on the autism spectrum, things like that, being able to catch mental illness issues at those younger ages can be hugely beneficial to students dealing with those types of issues.
This is Cross-Examine Life, the place where you're encouraged to ask more questions. The format is cross-exam, and the subject is chosen by the guest. Join us as we elevate the art of disagreement, unpack assumptions, and challenge beliefs, one question at a time.
Welcome to episode 41 of Cross-Examine Life, the show that improves the way we disagree with one another. I'm your host, Chris Tatum, and you'll enjoy this episode if you like conversations around mental health, privacy rights, and what level of government intervention is appropriate in solving our country's mental health crisis. Listeners recently have been saying such kind things about Cross-Examine Life. Recently, Stephanie wrote to me and said, "I've been binging this podcast whenever I get a free moment since Sunday when I first discovered its existence. It's phenomenal. It's intelligent people taking opposite sides of a subject and thoughtfully discussing their viewpoints on current and hot-button subjects. Bonus, you can even listen in the car with children present who will promptly ignore you and stop asking their own unending questions. I've found bliss." Stephanie, thank you so much for your kind words, and certainly encouragement like this that keeps me going, bringing you more episodes of Cross-Examine Life. This episode is sponsored by Luke Rafferty Visuals, a visual storytelling company that will help you take your brand, your message to the next level. If you need excellent photography or videography, go to lukeraffertyvisuals.com, mention Cross-Examine Life, and get $100 off your first video project. You can send me a text message at 1-307-240-9190. You can also leave a voice message, and if you do, I may play it on a future episode. You can also find us on the Facebook Cross-Examine Life community for an ongoing discussion about this episode. All right, without any further ado, here's Ryan defending the position that public schools should require yearly mental health evaluations.
The position that I'm defending today is that public schools should require yearly mental health evaluations for all students. I work with a lot of teenagers, college students, post-college students, and, you know, I'll get them, you know, they've been dealing with depression, they've been dealing with anxiety, you know, even in some cases, trauma or suicidal thoughts, really serious issues. And it'll come up, you know, is this the first time in treatment? And a large percentage of those cases, it is. So it's kind of shocking for me and sad in some cases to see that a person's been struggling so severely for so long without getting the support that they need. So that's anecdotally, but from a, you know, more statistic-based standpoint, the average delay between onset symptoms and intervention in the United States is 8 to 10 years. So that's, and the statistics that I'm bringing to you are all coming from NAMI, which is National Alliance on Mental Health, Mental Illness. So that kind of speaks to the problem that I'm seeing and why I would support this issue, at least at initially. That's sort of the first piece that I would want to go to. I don't know if you have any follow-up questions to that.
Absolutely. It sounds as if your biggest concern is this gap in time from when someone begins to suspect that they might be suffering from some mental health problem to the time that's actually diagnosed. Am I understanding that properly?
Yes, exactly what you said. So I'm seeing a patient, I ask them, you know, how long have you been feeling this way? And they say, as long as I can remember, or since eighth grade, or since first grade. And I'm getting them when they're 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 21. So that gap being really significant raises this question of, could the intervention have come much sooner?
Yeah. And I guess that raises in my mind the question of, is part of the reason that they're disclosing to you this issue that they have in their late teens or college years, perhaps because of their maturity?
Oh, no question. Maturity is certainly a part of it. But I think what's coming with the maturity is the sort of frequency that this issue is discussed. So as the students, for example, are maturing, these issues become on some levels more common, more commonly discussed, more almost like appropriate. You know, you'll see teens now on social media being somewhat, in some cases, much more open about things like wanting to self-harm or being depressed or being anxious. So in some ways, that's good that that's changing as they get older. But I don't think it's just simply maturity. I wish it was. I wish that was something that we could kind of chalk it up to that.
Well, I guess maybe what I'm getting at is it seems to me maybe there's something about one's age of sort of growing older, being able to sort of express yourself, talk about your feelings a little more detailed way in your sort of later teenage years. I mean, I feel like children aren't known for their wide vocabulary around emotion. You know, we wouldn't really expect them to be able to disclose these things, right?
So in my experience, sort of yes and no. The language is certainly different from, you know, your late teens to your children. But I've worked with 8 to 10-year-olds who are very capable of talking about how angry they are or the sort of grieving process that they're going through if their parents are going through divorce, for example. So from my perspective, even though if they don't have the language, they can absolutely still benefit from the conversation and from the skills that might be discussed if these issues and symptoms are caught at an earlier age.
If we're going to require school students to go through mental health evaluations, you know, it might actually be helpful for you sort of envisioning this to say a little bit about what you think that would look like as far as sort of who would perform it, you know, when during the school year, how long a session might be, what sort of protocols there would be. Do you want to talk a little bit about sort of how you envision that might go down?
Sure, absolutely. So I have like my best case scenario, and I have what would probably be most likely what would this would look like after going through all the different sort of regulatory bodies that would take to put this in place. But I would think that the sort of compromise area would be very similar to the medical model. Which is most schools require things like vaccinations, require things like yearly physicals, especially for things like sports teams and other sorts of school activities that they need to see that information. So the school does not necessarily provide the resources for you to go get a physical, but they still require it to happen. So from that end, it could be a very similar model that they would be requiring you to get a mental health evaluation. It would most likely come from, your sort of community mental health organizations. Although, as far as I'm concerned, primary care physicians are perfectly capable of conducting a basic mental health evaluation. So
you're not calling for like a psychologist to perform.
So I wouldn't say that would be required, because once you bring a psychologist into the question, that you are talking, you know, likely months of waiting times in some cases. Now, if they were as prevalent, especially in like rural areas, as I think everyone would like them to be, then yes, that's definitely best case. You have someone who's a licensed clinician or therapist, psychologist, would be conducting these evaluations. For me, that's the best case, absolutely. Or even further, you know, having a therapist or school psychologist that's able, or I guess multiple, you really, if you were doing every single child, were able to provide those services in the school, that's best case. But when we're talking about cost, I know that would be a concern.
So if a successful mental health evaluation needs the sort of patient's or student's participation in order to be successful, doesn't this rely in large part on a student's honesty to kind of be productive?
I would say yes and no. In an ideal case, you know, your patient or your student in this case is going to be 100% honest when they come in. But even when I get voluntary patients, I'm not expecting 100% honesty in the first session in that sort of evaluation situation. So with children, especially on the younger side, you're going to get a lot of variation in how open and honest they are in an evaluation setting. But if you do have someone who specializes in sort of children or child psychology, they're going to be able to pick up on the sort of specific evaluation pieces, whether it be things like body language, you know, sort of ability to express emotion, you know, ability to even speak in some cases, you know, for kids who are, let's say, on the autism spectrum, things like that, being able to catch mental illness issues at those younger ages can be hugely beneficial to students dealing with those types of issues. But yeah, to answer your question in terms of honesty, yes, it is absolutely important.
But if a student's dishonest because they feel sort of coerced to go to this evaluation that they don't want to go to, is that going to be productive at all for the professional?
I think it's still productive. I mean, I think the doctors on the physical side face similar issues. You know, you may have students who are dealing with, you know, not getting enough sleep or they don't eat great, but when they go see their doctor, how are you feeling? Yeah, everything's fine. Are you sleeping okay? Yeah, I'm fine. So even though that sort of initial engagement with the professional may not give you the complete picture, the more serious signs, which we'd be most concerned about, are going to be picked up in one way, shape, or form, whether that's in communication or lack thereof, or even in some cases, the sort of interaction with the parents, which you might see with the younger kids.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm glad that you're comparing it to the physical evaluations, because as I was thinking through this, it struck me that perhaps mental health evaluations would be objectionable to people because they're more intrusive, that a physical evaluation is limited largely by what can be seen and observed. Of course, there are those questions about sleep and yep. food and maybe sexual activity. But I mean, really, the essence of a mental health evaluation goes so much deeper, right? And it sort of requires this explanation that's extremely personal and intrusive, isn't it?
It is. And that's where this sort of honesty piece comes in, is that if, you know, especially, you know, if you're in most cases, you know, with an evaluation of a young child, going to get input from the parents. So in some cases, that's going to be best case scenario, because the parents could tell you things that the child might not. In some cases, the child might be inclined to share something that the parent might not want to be shared. So, you know, we could sort of suss out those details in terms of how and to what extent a family member might be involved in the evaluation. But I do think that there's benefits, just like you would have with a physical, you know, your parent would be in the room up to a certain age, and then the child can ask them to be outside the room. So we would be employing, I would imagine, a similar model here.
What do you do about the parent who says, this is, it's too intrusive. I don't want my child subjected to this line of questioning about their personal life by a stranger, psychoanalyzing my family. It's not my fault that I have to send my kid to public school because I can't afford private school. They're not going to be, you know, analyzed by this professional. I'm not comfortable with that.
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's honestly something that I see a lot with parents. You know, we'll get referrals from schools, you know, where the parents are not necessarily on board with their child needing that level of treatment. You know, the parents might say, oh, yeah, they, you know, they can come once a month. Meanwhile, when we see them one-on-one, we can see clear symptoms and clear need for a higher level of care than that, once a week, or in some cases, even more than that. So, you know, therapists are well-trained in sort of working with the parents, helping them to understand that if there are really no issues, then they have nothing to worry about. We're not going to recommend any unnecessary treatment. We're not going to sort of push any, especially things like medication, that parents get very hung up on issues like that. The evaluation is just that. It's to a check-in to determine if there are any sort of larger issues that need to be addressed. So if there really are no issues, then it will reveal that.
What if there are issues and they require follow-up? You talked about some students needing weekly check-ins or more than weekly. I mean, doesn't that make fitting in as a social matter for a student all the more difficult in a school environment, because their initial sort of evaluation revealed that they need all this extra help?
So yes, there are certainly questions or concerns around things like stigma. Are they going to be judged? Are they going to be anxious about being seen or known as the kid who's getting therapy, or the kids who are getting mental health support? But from what I've seen in schools that do have really good mental health support services, for example, I have school therapists that run groups. And the kids that join those groups, even if they were initially resistant or less than sure if that was going to be helpful, they can form some real positive bonds around seeing other kids who are dealing with similar issues to them. So while, yes, there is some concern around, and obviously, I mean, in an ideal situation, you would have full confidentiality and that stuff wouldn't get out. But we're dealing with schools, so obviously that's not always going to be the case.
Right. As far as individuals perhaps feeling treated differently, I wonder if there's a problem here, inherent problem with the position requiring these yearly mental health evaluations in public schools, that it sets up a dynamic where wealthier families who enroll their students in private school don't have to be subjected to this, particularly if they find it, you know, intrusive. They can kind of avoid it by paying that extra money to send their kids to private school, can't they?
Oh, absolutely. And my goal behind this kind of a policy proposal would be that if it were normalized in a public school setting, that would really push private schools I mean, you know, you can kind of almost work it the opposite way that, oh, the public schools are getting all these really in-depth services for their students. Private schools are going to want to now have similar services to show that they are equally supportive of their students and equally sort of aware of these mental health issues that could come up around this age. So I think you could actually use it as a form of competition among schools and sort of encourage those private schools to be on equal footing with the public schools that are now offering these services or at least encouraging the level of support.
Okay. But what do we do about the cost aspect of it? I mean, you have a lot of families enrolling their kids in public school because they can't afford private school. And now you're telling them they have to pay for one additional, you know, health evaluation before their kid can be enrolled.
Yeah. I mean, ideally, you know, in a world where all of these students have health insurance and a once yearly evaluation is going to be covered similarly the way a physical would be covered. But there's no question that there's going to be a cost associated with this, especially if students are found to have symptoms that require additional treatment. You know, that's going to put them into the sort of mental health system, which is, you know, once a week or once a month, individual therapy, even in the higher cases, you know, possibly needing medication. So there's no question that there's going to be cost involved. And I'll be honest, that's not something that in terms of sorting out the sort of from the government side, how things would be paid and, you know, on the private side, whether they would have to be paid for at all. That's definitely an issue here. But it's one that I would hope that, you know, based on a lot of the mental health issues that you see in schools, everything from suicides to gun violence, that we'd be able to kind of drum up some real logic behind this kind of proposal.
Okay. Until that law is passed that says schools have to absorb the cost of this, or, you know, local governments have to subsidize it for families that can't afford it, what's the actual predicament financially for families that have an obligation on them to have their student get a mental health evaluation? What are they looking at? I mean, is the average student covered under health insurance? Does it depend on mom and dad's work? I mean, what are the options there?
Yeah, so basically it comes down to mom and dad's insurance. You know, if they have private insurance, there's very little outlay on certain to that initial evaluation. You know, you're looking at whatever copay and coinsurance might exist, you know, depending on where you live, that's anywhere from $5 or $10 to, you know, $30, $40, $50, depending on the insurance. But for families who have, let's say, Medicare, Medicaid, it really depends on the provider. It depends on the availability. But again, you know, sort of similar within that range, probably closer to right in the middle, $20, $30, $40 for an evaluation. Not cheap, but reasonable if it's possibly catching the symptoms that we might be concerned about.
Okay. So if those symptoms are caught, if there's some concerning red flag raised, couldn't this cause the wrongful expulsion or removal of the child from school?
I would certainly hope not. I'm trying to think of a scenario in which a school would view a diagnosis or a symptom as problematic enough to expel them. Because if those symptoms already existed, I would imagine the school would be aware of them in the first place. Let's say in the case of a patient was or a student was found to have oppositional tendencies, you know, rule breaking, things like that. I would be really surprised if a school would go right off of that into, you know, almost forcing them to leave the school. You know, in most cases, and I work with a lot of schools, you know, they put things in place like a 504 plan or a treatment plan so that the student actually has extra care. So yeah, I would be really surprised if that was an outcome. Not saying that it wouldn't be, but
maybe I'm thinking of something that sounds a little more threatening on its face that isn't actually, where a student maybe, I don't know, really spends a lot of time playing violent video games or perhaps is fascinated with their parents' gun collection. And in their evaluation, they talk about sort of violent topics, maybe even topics related to gun violence. It seems to me possible that a family doctor or a therapist might arrive at the conclusion that that student poses a risk of gun violence to other students in the school. And I'm concerned that by going with your suggestion, students might be improperly expelled or removed from school just because they're kind of thinking about these ideas and, you know, maybe not seriously, but they're kind of crossing their mind.
Yeah, I do think that's a reasonable question. I think part of the thing that comes up for me is sort of the extent to which the information in the evaluation is confidential. So for example, you know, you just have to get a letter saying that you had a physical. The physical doesn't say, at least to my knowledge, that you give to a school. It doesn't say your cholesterol levels or your, I'm trying to even now remember the things that you had for a physical at that age. So in terms of the information that would be provided to the school, the onus would be on the evaluator to share the level of concern that they have. Now, to your question, if there's a concern about danger to others, you know, that is a question that absolutely would come up in an evaluation. And if it was determined that that was a potential issue, it would absolutely be communicated. That would be, you know, essentially duty to warn. So that would be on the onus, again, of the evaluator to determine to the extent to which that person is a danger, and if they are, what interventions would be available to them and to the school.
But it doesn't sound like you're overly concerned about a overprotective therapist or other individual doing the diagnosis making some sort of recommendation that might keep that student out of school unnecessarily.
Well, just based on my experience, that's not ever something that I've seen. Now, it doesn't mean that it couldn't happen. Obviously, there are schools and probably even school districts or parts of the country where certain behaviors would be viewed of, let's say, varying concern. But I do think that in general, you know, if you get a well-trained therapist or clinician or psychologist or even doctor who does mental health evaluations, they're going to be able to determine the level of which a patient is a risk to themselves or others. You know, playing violent video games, even being quote unquote obsessed with those video games, to me and to most therapists, is not going to be a cause for concern that they would need to communicate that to a school on its own.
Yeah. You talked about building a groundswell of support around potential legislation that would make this required and help it be paid for by those who, you know, couldn't afford to pay for it themselves. And I guess I'm thinking of the struggle that exists right now in public schools across really the world, certainly in the United States, to pay for the basics, to pay for erasers, to pay for chalkboards, to pay for projectors. We're struggling to pay for those things. How are we ever going to find the money, to budget the money, to pay for something like mental health that seems like a priority after those other things I mentioned? Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, I absolutely would agree. Luckily, there are already some things sort of on board for public schools. For example, the group practice that I work at, it has a partnership with some local public schools called CII, it's a children's initiative, where indigent families, and it goes through, I want to say like the food stamps program that already exists, that it does cover a certain amount of the services. So whether it just gives, let's say the families like a $5 copay as opposed to the $20, $30, $40, $50 that they'd be paying on private insurance. So it does, there are already things in place that we would be able to reference saying, this exists. Wouldn't it be nice if it was on a larger scale? And you'd be able to have families who could say, yes, my son or daughter got services they wouldn't have been able to get otherwise. So I think there are things in place that we could build upon, but there is no question that cost is going to be a huge question and you know, battleground, I think, issue in getting this kind of a resolution passed.
Okay. But to be clear, you're not trying to sort of squeeze in line ahead of the funds for projectors and erasers and chalkboards?
No. I'm pretty well aware that public schools, even thinking about like teachers having to buy their own school supplies and things like that, like I'm well versed on the issues that exist there. My hope would be that between, let's say, community mental health organizations, because I think, you know, speaking as a therapist, I also want to see these kids get evaluated and get the care that they need. And that's not saying that mental health therapists and psychologists are going to do things for free, but I think that there is a large desire to make sure these kids get the care that they need to whatever extent possible. So I think that there'd be some coalitions around supporting this issue.
And I guess my final question is about the students who are from families that don't have any experience treating mental health issues, that don't have experience seeing therapists, going to counseling, and the parents aren't in any position to provide greater insight. And the kid knows that they have to go for this mental health evaluation, and it seems scary. It seems intimidating. Mm-hmm. they know they're going to be asked some tough questions, and they're just afraid, and they tell their parents they don't want to go. What do you say to that kid? What do you say to those parents?
Yeah, I definitely see that, you know, because I get the other side as well, where I'll have parents who their children wants to, they think that their child needs some level of evaluation or treatment, and the child's not on board. What I say to the child when they're willing enough to come see me for one evaluation or one session is that it is not my job to force them into doing anything that they don't want to do. My job is to help them make sure the goals that they have, whether that be just to be healthy, to do well in school, you know, to have friends, to go to college, whatever it might be, that they're on track for those things, that they're generally content in sort of the way things are going in those directions. And to kind of take down the sort of threat factor that I do think, to your point, exists both on the child side and the family side, to be able to lower that as much as possible, that me as a therapist, I'm on their side. I'm not on the school side. I'm not on the government side. I'm not trying to create a problem where there is none. I want to help them accomplish what they want. And if there's nothing wrong, I don't want them to have anything unnecessary. So if anything, I would be sort of trying to get them on board with not needing treatment. Like, let me convince your school that nothing is wrong here. So let's just talk about how things are going so that we can make sure that's the case.
Okay. Well, at the end of every episode, Ryan, I give my guests the opportunity to indicate if their position or perspective or opinion has changed in any way. So I just ask you to share if your thoughts, opinions, or perspective has changed in any way.
Yeah, sure. So I really appreciate the questions that you asked. It does make me think about sort of some of the wrinkles that come up around this issue, you know, because I know, especially the sort of worst case scenarios that I'm thinking about, where parental abuse is going to be revealed, or domestic violence is going to be revealed, or other problems at home are going to be revealed because a child is coming in for an evaluation that they wouldn't have otherwise had. But I'm firm in my belief on this point that if those issues are not revealed, that's a worst case for the child. Now, there's no question that sort of initial process of, okay, there's this problem, how are we going to deal with it? That's going to be a bumpy road. But the alternative of just sort of leaving everything under the rug and hoping for the best is what creates these bigger problems that we see with, you know, kids 8 to 10 years down the road finally getting help. And, oh, yeah, by the way, you know, I, you know, saw my dad, you know, beat up my mom 10 years ago, and I've been depressed ever since. So I'm pretty firm on my standpoint, but I realize that it's going to take a lot of work for us to get there.
Well, Ryan, I appreciate you coming on the show and taking the time to so thoughtfully lay out your position.
All right. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. And thanks for having me on.
Of course. Now it's time for Practical Takeaway Tips, the part of the show where I give you practical tips that you can use in your next disagreement that have been extracted from today's cross-exam. There's three of them. First, repeat the other person's explanation in your own words. This not only ensures that you're beginning from that common definition I spoke about, but it respectfully shows the other person that you're hearing and understanding them. Second, after providing a more detailed and nuanced explanation, come back to the original question. Ask yourself whether or not you fully answered that question, and if, on balance, the answer to the question asked was one way or another, just indicate that. Say, yes, it's more so that way, or no, it's actually the other way. That helps the logical flow of ideas, and it shows respect for your conversation partner. Third, resist the temptation to call one more question your last or final question. Simply ask the question, and then reevaluate the need for additional questions. So what do you think of today's cross-exam? I'd encourage you to join our Facebook community, Cross Examine Life Community, and let other listeners know. There, in that Facebook group, you can find summaries of Ryan's argument and an ongoing discussion about whether or not he proved his point. Well, that'll about do it for today's Cross Exams. If you enjoyed them, please leave us a rating in the iTunes store, and mention this show next time you're swapping podcast recommendations with friends.
Thanks so much for listening. If you liked what we're doing here, find more of our questions on iTunes and Stitcher. If you want to propose a topic or sign up to be a guest, please visit us at crossexaminedlife.com.